Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. This is episode 12. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
How you doing?
All right.
So we're up to a dozen episodes and 100 downloads.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get to see that, or I don't pay attention to that. I'm sorry. I'm okay. Thankful to everybody who downloads and listens to us, or they can even just download it and not listen what you do.
It looks the same either way.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I think that's impressive since, you know, nobody knows us.
We're not exactly, famous before this.
No,
nope. No. So, what's going on?
Oh, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
And so we're now 2 weeks out of Memorial Day weekend.
Right.
And so Memorial Day was like the big everybody get together. Let's see how we do this.
Yep.
Kind of thing. Do you know, are we seeing increases? Or are we still following directions and being good?
So those are good questions. I haven't looked at data, in the past couple of days because I try not to spend all of my time always thinking about the coronavirus. But, the parts of the country, looking at the New York Times map of where cases are increasing, staying about the same, or decreasing, they have a map that breaks that down by county and is color-coded sort of with the scale of how fast things are increasing, going to a sort of midpoint of staying about the same, and then some places are even, decreasing. The largest concentration of counties where things were increasing was in the southeast of the United States, where the restrictions seem to have been earliest to be removed or rolled back, eased, I guess is what I'm looking for, early on. There's a little bit of, there's a potential there for the ecological fallacy that just because there's a correlation there at a large mm-hmm. spatial scale doesn't necessarily mean that there's a causal relationship. Part of the reason why cases could be increasing in that part of the country is that things had not spread there, as extensively, right? The epicenters of the outbreak seem to have been the Northwest and the Northeast early on. And so, it could just be that it's hitting new parts of those states in the southeast where it hadn't hit at all. And so you're going to get little spikes, even with, even with restrictions and stay at home and so forth. So, that's not an accusation about anybody in particular, any region in particular, just an observation that that's what the map was showing.
And I'm sure it's something to just keep an eye on and see what happens. My understanding is, the people like you and in other areas of public health, this is what life is going to look like, going forward until there is actually a vaccine that you all are going to need to be paying attention to these numbers a little bit more carefully to be anticipating potential trends for.
Right. Well, we don't know for certain what is going to happen in all these cases. The risk of spread outdoors seems to be less than the risk of spread indoors. So some of these outdoor Memorial Day activities or the outdoor protests may not be as risky as, spending 8 hours indoors, with mm-hmm. coworkers in an office setting, or spending, 2 or 3 hours in a movie theater with people, or, in church and singing and so forth.
The masks, how much people are wearing masks or not wearing masks, even, when they're outdoors and close together, like in some of those situations, that can have an impact. So just because people are mixing more doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be more transmission. Mm-hmm. There's also still some open questions about whether there's any sort of seasonality to this virus and whether it's...
And it's still too early to really see that for sure, I'm guessing. I would think the Southeast United States tends to be warmer, sunnier all the time.
Right. So if I had to guess now, I would guess that there probably isn't a strong seasonal component because we've seen plenty of transmission in places where it's been mm-hmm. warmer. And, in like Australia and New Zealand, which are entering their winter, they're at fairly low levels of transmission. Mm-hmm. New Zealand is talking about starting film production back up again and things like that.
I know they were saying that South America is kind of I don't know if it's South or Central America is kind of another big epicenter right now.
Right. So Brazil is having a big increase in cases, other parts of South America and Central America. Yeah. And so, it's clear that even if there is some amount of mitigation of spread from weather-related conditions, either, humid air makes the virus less likely to spread, or people's immune systems work a little bit differently in warmer, mm-hmm. humid weather versus dry, cold weather, or, we're just spending less time inside in dry air, heat conditions. All those questions, all those things are reasons why we think the flu spreads more in the winter and less in the summer. And it may very well be a combination of all those things mm-hmm. that play into the flu. And those could be playing, some or all of those could have a role with the coronavirus as well. However, because we have such a naive population, there's so many people that have no existing immunity to this virus at all, then you're still going to get a lot of spread, even if there's some reduction due to those factors. So if I had to guess, I would guess that there's not going to be a strong seasonal component, at least not this year. Maybe, going forward, if we build up more immunity, it might start to turn into something a little bit more like the flu, mm-hmm. with a seasonal component. But I think for this year, it's looking unlikely, but it's also really hard to tell because you've got so many other things going on. You've got the virus hitting new parts of the world, new parts of the country that it hasn't hit before. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you're going to see an uptick in cases, even because it's warm. Even if the transmission is less than it would have been if it was colder, you're still going to see transmission. You're still going to see spikes in cases. Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be easy to tease out. And then you've got the shifts in behavioral patterns, like the stay-at-home orders are changing. The rules about, sizes of gatherings that are permissible and all these different things are changing at the same time as the weather is changing. And so all of that makes it harder to tease out the separate effects to be able to identify exactly what's going on.
Here's a question for you that might be kind of out of left field because it just popped into my head. Thinking about the flu, the annual flu and the annual flu vaccine, we've talked before about how like research is kind of been harder to do because universities and labs have been kind of shut down or working remotely. Is there going to be a delay in the flu vaccine for this year, or is that something that would have already been kind of been working on before? And we haven't talked about this before yet, so it's possible that you sometimes look things up before. I haven't given you that chance today.
Right. So the development of the annual flu vaccine is not primarily an academic research lab activity.
Okay.
Right? It's a fairly well-defined process for which there are some government entities that are involved. And then obviously the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture the vaccine are involved. And so I, you're right that I haven't looked into that specifically. I would guess that all of that fell under the essential business covered. And so those jobs were continuing because it would be a very unfortunate situation to go into this coming winter mm-hmm. without a flu vaccine, you know, on top of everything else.
Well, I'm thinking there's going to be a harder push for more and more people to get the flu vaccine this year, so that, you know, there's some kind of mitigation between, you know, dealing with both flu and COVID-19.
Right. If nothing else, getting, you know, certainly the flu vaccine is not going to protect you from the coronavirus. Yeah. However, you know, assuming that we are able to continue to control the spread of the virus so that, you know, through the summer and the early fall, so that, you know, most of the population of the United States is still therefore susceptible to the virus. And, you know, we should add that, you know, although there is some evidence to suggest that, you know, it's possible to get protective immunity by being infected from the virus, it's still kind of an open question as well. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, you know, talking about as if there kind of are people who are immune, but we don't even know that for sure. But we're kind of operating on the assumption that
every month, every week, that kind of, okay, you're still immune. That seems good.
right. But because, you know, and especially now that, you know, transmission is being more controlled or whatever, are these people not getting sick again because they're immune or because they're not getting exposed to the virus again? So, you know, there's good reason to think that there is at least, you know, some amount of immunity that lasts for months or years based on other coronaviruses and based on, you know, these early challenge studies in monkeys and the fact that, you know, the first phase clinical trials are the humans are producing antibodies that can prevent infection of cell cultures by the virus. All that is pointing to the fact that there's probably some level of immunity, but we don't know exactly how much and how long it will last. But if we operate on the assumption that it does provide some immunity, but that most of us won't have been infected come fall, there will still be the possibility of a big wave that overwhelms the hospitals if we allow transmission to just go unabated the way that it had been, you know, in February, for example. So, you know, we're obviously going to try to avoid that if we can. You know, if the fairly optimistic, you know, Warp Speed project gets us a vaccine by, you know, late fall, you know, November timeline, which is kind of like the very earliest, you know, window that they're talking about, which, you know, is very optimistic. And there's a lot of things that can get in the way of that. But, you know,
not everybody is going to be able to run out and get it.
I mean, you know, that's what they're promising. I don't know how plausible that is, but that's kind of what they're talking about, is not just it will work by, we'll have one that works by, you know, the end of the year, but we'll have one that works and that we can give to people.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that's partly because they're basically saying we're willing to invest the money in starting to manufacture this vaccine before we know for sure that that it will work, is basically what that's going to take. And when I say this vaccine, it may be several different candidates that we'll need to be able to scale up to all that. So if we're in that situation, obviously that would be good as well. But assuming that's not the case, there's the risk that if we don't do anything, that if we just kind of go back to the way things were in January and February, and we get a big second wave, we could overwhelm the hospital system again. And if we had on top of that the flu season, those are the same kind, the same respirators, the same ICU units.
Those are the same really, really vulnerable people, except with flu, you're also looking at a lot of, like, younger kids are also, you know, whereas we've seen COVID tends to be, for the most part, not as impactful on kids. Flu is not like that.
Right. There is some risk of severe flu for the very young as well as the very old. And so for, you know, because there's a lot of overlap in the needs and you're right, in the people who are at risk, it would be a very good idea for as many people as possible to get the flu vaccine this fall when it is available, when the new formulation for this year is available. And so for that reason, I can't imagine that they're not working on, you know, this is about the time of year when they're working out what strain needs to go, which strains of the flu need to go into the vaccine for the coming fall, so that they can ramp up production, so that they can have the doses available for the fall.
And I think I remember hearing in the past, like, some of that is indicated by looking at, like, Australia, because they're going into winter now, so they kind of see...
Right, so so there's always, it's always flu season somewhere, yeah. Kind of the way that it works out.
Kind of like happy hour.
Kind of, except very, very
yeah,
different.
Not.
So ideally, you know, you'd want to know what flu vaccine is, what flu virus, rather, is circulating in the Northern Hemisphere in October mm-hmm. to be able to make the flu vaccine for that flu season. But that's too late.
Yeah.
There just isn't the time to scale up the number of doses. And so, yeah, it's more like this time of year, we're looking at what is emerging in the Southern Hemisphere for their winter flu season, for, you know, at least the temperate parts of the Southern Hemisphere for their winter flu season, to see, you know, there's generally some correlation between that and what winds up circulating in the Northern Hemisphere during our flu season. It's not perfect. And that's why that's a big reason why some years the flu vaccine is a better match and offers better protection than other years, because we just have to do that. That we have to make that decision so early. And, you know, with all of this new vaccine technology that we've been talking about, these new style vaccines based on RNA or DNA or, you know, other kinds of vector viruses or other ways of sort of growing just individual proteins from the viruses, all that may eventually lead to a better flu vaccine, either one that is more universal so that we don't need to make a new one every year, or one that can be made more rapidly so that we can make that decision later and later into the year and make it more likely.
As we see.
Yeah, or even possibly adjust during the flu season. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not going to happen for this flu season, but that's definitely something that's part of what's being investigated, is how to make that decision. You know, how to make that flu vaccine match better to what's circulating in a given flu season by being able to make that decision later.
So going back to coronavirus, and the other thing that you kind of touched on is we're in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. We are green as of Friday. However... I was having a conversation with someone the other night, and we were talking about how that green can kind of be an interesting way of showing the opening back up, because green kind of lets us think, go back to normal. But that's really not exactly how, I don't know, maybe I'm on the more cautious side of things, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, just looking at, you know, the rules that have been put in place, green does not mean there are no more rules and you can go back to doing things as you had been in January and February. Green still means there are restrictions on what can happen. In the state of Pennsylvania, it means that gatherings of over 250 people are still not permitted. You can't organize one or attend one. As I understand it, exceptions have been carved out for religious services on that particular point, but generally speaking, no more than 250 people, and so that means that, you know, baseball games still, you know, they're talking about a baseball season without crowds. That's, you know, they're going to still have to do that for
I'm
the time
going
being.
To refrain from commenting on.
The Pirates might be more familiar with what that feels like than some other teams, I think, is where you're going with that.
Sorry, we love the Pirates. They'll get back someday.
Businesses,
concerts,
concerts, all those kinds of things.
Yeah. This kind of like this week is the arts festival, which they've put all. So even though that's an outdoor festival, they've put it online just to
mitigate
how many people.
Right, because it's going to be difficult to impossible to keep people 6 feet apart in a setting like that, even though it's outdoors. Yeah, and so there are all those kinds of things that are still not permitted. You know, the wearing of masks is still, you know, the wording is maybe a little bit hard, you know, a little bit unclear as to, you know, where the line is. You know, in a lot of places, you know, a lot of businesses are saying that they're going to, when they reopen, like movie theaters and places have come out and said, we're going to encourage but not require that our customers wear masks.
Yeah, I heard, I read a post from a business that said, our duty is to tell you that you should wear a mask. Whether you wear the mask is up to you, but we are required, their words were, for us, it's a, we shall tell you to wear a mask, but you don't but it's not necessarily a shall wear a mask for you. So it's like, well, it's a really difficult kind of
situation. We've created a weird situation where, you know, the employees of retail stores and movie theaters and restaurants are the ones on the front lines of enforcing these rules. And they've not, you know, they've not been trained for that. They're not being paid well enough to deal with the, you know, the hassles that come with that in most cases. And, you know, there are, and presumably they're isolated incidents, but they're, you know, incidents that have made the news of significant, you know, conflict between customers or patrons and employees who are trying, who are just trying to do what they understand that they need to do of encouraging people to wear masks. And so, you know, I can totally sympathize with the businesses who are kind of like, we didn't ask to be put in the middle of this. We're not the police. We're not the, you know, the state. We're not in charge of.
Well, and I think ultimately we need to remember that as a community, we're being asked to wear a mask to protect the workers in these stores. Like, you know, there have been all kinds of posts in celebration about, you know, these are our first line responders. These are the people that are keeping everything going. We appreciate them. We love them. Okay, so wear the mask when you go in the store and just be kind.
Right. The masks, you know, especially the cloth masks, the surgical style masks, the homemade style masks, their greatest benefit is protecting other people from whatever infection that you might have, whether you think that you have it or not, because people can have it and not have symptoms and not be aware. And so, yeah, it's less about protecting yourself because it, you know, it does offer some, but not complete protection for yourself. But if we're all wearing it and protecting each other, then we get the biggest benefit. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a courtesy, you know, not that it just, you know, a token thing. Like, it's not just about it does have an actual practical benefit.
You think about, you know, all the evidence says that being inside, being in closed spaces, ups the level of transmission. So you think about, you know, the guy stocking the shelves. He is coming in contact with all kinds of products. He's also coming in contact with not only you who runs into the store and grabs something and goes, who might think, oh, I'm just going in for like 2 minutes to get this one thing. Like, but no, it's like every other person that comes in. And, you know, I've seen the lines at Giant Eagle and some of these stores. There's a lot of people that come in and are in there for a long period of time. And so that's just like, that's one of those, okay, let's take that. We support them and really, you know, mm-hmm. show them that support.
Yep. Yeah. So being respectful of the folks who work in these various places, being respectful of the other patrons, especially, you know, patrons who might be more at risk than yourself. You know, wearing a mask, you know, certainly indoor, in any kind of indoor context. And, you know, really even in a lot of outdoor contexts where there's a possibility, you know, of prolonged, you know, interaction with other people in close quarters. You know, some of these, you know, I'm glad to see how many folks are wearing masks at these demonstrations and protests, for example. Yeah. You know, I appreciate that, you know, there's a lot of different things going on in those contexts and that they are showing their care for their fellow citizens, not just by protesting, but also by wearing masks to protect them from the virus and, you know, in the context of those protests.
Yeah, it's impressive to see, you know, so many people willing to take that risk of, like, going and being in close quarters, but still trying to kind of, you know, take care of each other. It's really nice to see. So, you know, we'll see how that goes.
You know. Yeah, and so hopefully that, you know, the combination of being outside and wearing a mask means that those are not turning into super spreader events.
Yeah.
And know, I mean, certainly I hope that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll definitely be hoping that's what happens. But it is good to see that there are so many people who are really taking that aspect of it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the next thing, there is more exciting news about or maybe not exciting, in the
hydroxychloroquine.
I am never going to be able to say that. I feel really, really frustrated. I need to practice that more.
I'm sorry. So we talked just a couple episodes ago about a study on hydroxychloroquine that did not show any benefit, and if anything, showed a slight risk of more serious outcomes for patients who were being given it. It was an observational study, which means that they weren't randomly assigning patients to get the treatment or not. It was based on the discretion of their physicians and the hospital protocols and all that. But it was a very large study. It was about 96,000 patients total, so, you know, some of which got the hydroxychloroquine and some of which didn't. And so, you know, it was a worthwhile thing to look at and see, you know, given the data that we have available and while we're still waiting for these clinical trials to play out, what can we learn from this data set? And the answer was basically, you know, my takeaway from that was that it was, you know, in line with what we already kind of knew, that if there was a benefit, it was going to be, you know, smaller to detect, and so maybe hard to find in this kind of observational study, where the patients who are given the drug are potentially more likely to have been more seriously ill, and that's why somebody decided to treat them with something that was unproven in the first place. And so a smaller effect would be harder to find in that kind of context. And, you know, a negative effect, like, you know, more serious outcomes for people who were getting the treatment, was a likely outcome, both because we already knew that the drug had some risk of serious side effects involving, you know, heart conditions, and because those, it may be given to patients who are already worse off in the first place. And so I saw it as, you know, kind of a negative or a null result, in that it didn't really add a whole lot to the conversation. But it was still worth doing, because, you know, if it had found something different, that would have been potentially more informative. And so I didn't think much more of it at the time, just kind of this was being talked about. It was a big study, and so it seemed worth bringing up, but I didn't think much more other than that. But it turns out that the WHO decided to pause their clinical trial on hydroxychloroquine to make sure that they were not seeing the same kinds of negative results, not negative, but same kinds of worse outcomes for patients on that drug. So they're doing, the WHO is overseeing a large multi-arm clinical trial. And they call that because an arm is a particular therapy. So some people were getting the hydroxychloroquine, some people were getting a combination of drugs that, antiviral drugs, that have been used for other viruses. And I think there was a third arm, and I'm forgetting right now what the treatment was in that arm. But, you know, that's what they mean by an arm, is a different kind of therapy. And then there were people who weren't getting any therapy.
And this is all over the world.
All over the world.
Yeah, study. Which is, that's what we want.
We want to
have different populations being given these different treatments, so you have a broader understanding of what kind of effects it will have.
Exactly. And so basically when I say that they paused it, basically they said, okay, we're not going to randomly assign anybody to the hydroxychloroquine group while we're still looking at it. Mm-hmm. And so they paused that part of their study for a while. Some other places also made some either temporary decisions based on that result. And then just this past week, some questions were raised about where the data came from that went into this study. And as a result of that, the co-authors of the study, so there were basically four authors of the study, one of whom was from a company called Surgisphere that provided the data. And basically the other co-authors of the study said that we've been unable to look more deeply into where this data, to see for ourselves where this data is coming from and what the quality of it is and what's in this data. And so we no longer feel confident that we can put our names on this paper, so we would like for it to be retracted. And so it had been published. It wasn't just a preprint, like we've talked about,
okay,
you know, where it just the authors have written it up and shared it with the world. It's actually gone through the peer review process. It was published as an official paper in The Lancet.
So there were lots of people who read through all of this and thought that you felt that it was sound.
There were, you know, generally there's like three reviewers that'll review a paper. and then, you know, the editorial staff of the journal itself, who are, you know, not necessarily, who are themselves generally practicing scientists and not, you know, full-time editors. But, you know, so maybe probably on the order of 4 to 6 scientists looked at this paper in detail and said, yes, it passes muster and can be published. And so it was published. And then, you know, just the other day, it was retracted, which it basically means, in this case, not so much, we've definitely found that it was wrong. And I don't think we can say that at this point. It just said, we are no longer confident in the results. And so we think it should be kind of pulled back for now.
So the question is around the data. Is it a question of what the data is, or is it simply a question of where this company got the data?
So it's kind of a question of how they're collecting the data, who's actually getting it and aggregating, and how it's being processed to give the results.
Okay.
So that, you know, there's been mention of registries, and so there's some question of, okay, well, is this company, Surgisphere, are they directly getting the data from the hospitals, or are they, there are other places actually aggregating that data and then generating a registry of information and then passing that on to Surgisphere, questions like that. And then, you know, how was Surgisphere identifying which records should be part of the study and which records, you know, how were they figuring out who got which treatments and who had which outcomes? Those, you know, there were some questions about that haven't been answered to everyone's satisfaction yet. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they're kind of saying, all right, we need to take a minute to look into this in more detail.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily this like conspiratorial, oh, they were trying. It's some more questions arose about the process of, you know, not only getting the data, but then looking and you know, making decisions from the data. And so, you know, taking a step back and kind of reevaluating, re-examining things doesn't necessarily, you know, that's what we should want.
Yeah.
Because it's going to give us a clearer picture, especially since in this case where it seemed like there was not really an impact, you know, by re-examining it, we could hopefully potentially get a more definitive answer of, you know, this is definitely harmful, this is definitely beneficial in these instances, you know.
Yeah, so I don't think that it's likely that this particular study is going to, the outcome is going to change, right? That we're going to find a different result once we've sort of re-dug into the data.
Okay.
And even if we did, it's still it still has methodological limitations. It's still an observational study. So the best answer is still going to come from these clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the WHO, about the time that this paper was retracted, the WHO announced that they had reviewed their own data from their clinical trial, which is something that happens periodically anyway with these kinds of clinical trials, is that you review your numbers as you're going along to make sure that you're not doing harm.
Yeah.
And so forth. And so they reviewed their data. They said, we're not seeing the same kinds of, at least the same magnitude of potential harm that was reported in this study, which again, could be because of the difference between an observational study and a randomized trial.
Okay.
And not just because something was wrong about this Lancet paper that's been retracted. And so they said, we're not seeing the same thing, so we feel like it's appropriate to continue with our clinical trial. And so they actually have resumed assigning people randomly to that arm of the trial.
Well, that's good.
And other, you know, the WHO trial is not the only one that's going on. There's an NIH-funded trial that is also looking at hydroxychloroquine. And there are other ongoing trials that are looking at hydroxychloroquine with zinc, that combination that we talked about in that same episode. Uh-huh. So research, you know, continues. We're still looking for therapies. Nobody's ruled out anything
because of this. And this is what we want. And, you know, the results of this study didn't, you know, we're not like negatively harming. We're not harming people as a result of this study.
I don't think, based on the evidence, there's any reason to think that, there's any difference in what we understand about hydroxychloroquine than we did before COVID-19 came around. Because again, this was a drug that we'd used to treat malaria that we knew had some, you know, side effects. And so none of that has changed, you know, that understanding of the risks involved was there to begin with and is still there, you know, so it's not a completely innocuous thing to take. And again, just to reiterate it, you know, should only be taken under the direction of a physician in a, you know, in a clinical setting. But, you know, we should continue to evaluate it in these kinds of clinical trials because these randomized trials are it's the study design that it gives us the best insight into how effective a therapy like this can be. And these other things, you know, these other kinds of studies are good as a first step to kind of see, is it worth even pursuing? Because these big randomized clinical trials are expensive and time consuming, and we don't want to spend time chasing treatments that don't work if we have some reason to think that they don't work in the first place or that they're going to cause harm in the first place. And so that's why we do these other kinds of studies that are easier to do, but less likely to give definitive answers. And that's always, you know, you generally need some amount of that when you try to apply for a clinical trial. You need some kind of reason to think that it's going to provide some evidence in the first place.
Yeah.
Whether that's from, you know, animal studies or these observational human studies or whatever it might be, you have to have some reason to think that this is worth trying. Because otherwise, if you just go, you know, in the chemical cabinet and pull out everything that we have and throw it into a randomized clinical trial, and that wouldn't be a good use of time or resources, and it wouldn't be fair to the patients because you'd have no reason to think that it would necessarily help them. I think my, you know, biggest takeaway is, you know, I think this does highlight that, you know, that individual studies, you know, and this is always a tension in science reporting and the conversation of science. Individual studies are not always the end all and be all of an answer on an individual question, especially things that aren't, you know, especially when there are these observational studies in drug therapies, for example. It's, you know, it's rarer in biomedical research that one paper is the answer, whether that's nutrition advice and diet advice, mm-hmm. whether that's, you know, particular drug treatments or whatever it is. We generally need to have multiple papers and, you know, multiple studies to get a real clear answer on things, because there can be differences in different groups of people or differences in methodology or what have you. And so you want to kind of get that consensus, not from multiple scientists, but from multiple research studies that point to they're converging on the same answer. However, there's no triggering event for the news to report on that convergence of things. What happens that it seems newsworthy is the publishing of individual studies. And so that's what generally gets talked about. And in this kind of situation where we're all curious about what's going on, we all want to know the latest information, it's understandable that we're going to talk about, you know, individual studies. At the same time, just because something has come out in a journal, you know, and it, you know, is a peer-reviewed publication, that peer review is looking for certain kinds of things and not other kinds of things. And so questions may come up after peer review where you say, okay, we need to explore this a little bit further. Oftentimes that happens because other groups are not able to reproduce the results, or, you know, there isn't that convergence. Like, you have a big study that showed one thing and looked like the results were going to go one way. And then everybody else starts doing studies and coming up with the opposite answer. And so then you start to go, well, why did those people get such a different answer? And you start doing that digging to kind of find out. And sometimes that is what reveals reasons why, you know, methodological issues, on very, very rare occasions, you know, genuine fraud, and so forth. But yeah, so that, you know, the peer review process isn't necessarily designed to identify all of those things, especially, you know, if people really want to fraud, you know, to defraud the system, they're going to be able to, at least temporarily, until, you know, until other people try to get the same results.
Well, and when it comes to questions of data, it's not really like people manipulating data in this, you know, in these cases of these observational studies.
You know, in this particular instance, I don't think anybody really knows that there is anything wrong or has a particular hypothesis about what's wrong. They're just not getting all the answers that they would like to be
able
to get.
I'm just thinking, when you hear problem with data, I think a lot of the general population is going to gravitate to that idea. Oh, somebody's playing with the numbers to try and make them be. But in this case, like, that's really unlikely, because, you know, if you're going to play with numbers, why would you have results that were kind of inconclusive?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's hard to really say what's going on in this particular situation. I think it's worth exploring further. I don't think there's nothing that I've seen so far suggests that there actually is reason to think that anybody was up to anything inappropriate. It's just a matter of, it's a private company that has different ways of operating than academic research labs. And so I think that's, to me, that's one of the interesting things, one of the important things that is coming out of this particular study. Not that it's unique to this study, but this is kind of more of a high profile example of it, that, we're probably going to see more and more of this kind of research where, collaborations between private companies that are able to collect lots and lots of electronic healthcare data, and academic institutions and academic researchers who are going to do research on that data. And, they're not necessarily going to have full access to, the raw data that that company is collecting, because their agreements under which they're collecting it may not allow for that. And their own business practices may not allow for that. And so I think we probably have to figure out a little bit more carefully, how do we do studies like that to make sure that they're being done appropriately. The academic investigators may need a little bit more training on what are the questions that I should be asking so that I don't find myself in the situation where I have to say, I need to retract this paper because I no longer feel I can put my name on it. We don't want to get in that situation. Mm-hmm. We don't want to put people in that situation. And so how do we train them better to be able to ask those kinds of questions? And, how do we review these papers so that we understand better where the data is coming from? I'll be honest, so I work for a company that collects healthcare data from hospitals, all across the country. And there, I saw some things that were very similar between our company and Surgisphere. And some of the initial things that people felt were a little bit strange looked to me like, well, that's, perfectly fine. They're like, it's a small company with only 11 employees and most of them aren't scientists. It's like, well, that's the place where I work too. Yeah. That doesn't mean we're up to anything wrong. Just means that the nature of the work that we're doing is not scientific. We're not a science lab. We're a software company. So yeah, a lot of people that work for us are software developers and have business backgrounds or programming backgrounds. So it's a way of doing science that looks different than we're used to. And so I think that means we need to be able to ask different questions. And so I read the method section of the paper and I went, okay, some of it feels a little bit fluffy, like, they're sort of not exactly, advertising, but, it definitely is talking up the capabilities of this company to collect this data. And maybe there's some more details that I would like to see here, but, nothing stood out to me as like, oh my goodness, why doesn't it mention this or why does it mention that? It was more just like, that's a lot of data. That's an impressive, thing that they're able to get all this data from these hospitals all around the world. And, how exactly is that working? Because I know, that's complicated and so forth. But, nothing, there was no obvious like, this is definitely a problem or this is definitely impossible or whatever. And the other thing is that I know that, some of these higher prestige journals like The Lancet, they tend to not have the most extensive method sections and details in their papers because they're trying to focus on kind of shorter, clear, like punchy communication of let's get to the point of what's relevant and timely and important about this particular study. And that's not to say, that's not that they're like cutting corners or anything like that. No. That's the style of paper. Those journals tend to publish shorter, more concise papers that summarize methods more than go into every last exacting detail.
That doesn't mean that there's no record of what the whole method was.
Right, Right. And sometimes there'll be supplemental things so that, you know, what you get, because, you know, because they're still in the business of printing physical paper, you know, magazines, essentially. And so oftentimes there'll be online supplements because they don't want to have to print as many pieces of paper. And so that, you know, the more details might be in those online supplements. And so it didn't, you know, the fact that it was maybe a little bit briefer in its description of some of these things didn't stand out to me as, oh, this is definitely a problem, more just, oh, that's the style of this journal's publications. So given that I don't know that I would have flagged it as, I, you know, this is a problem, I can certainly understand where a reviewer who's even less familiar with health informatics and the business of all these kinds of things would just kind of look at that and say, okay, they're getting data. Am I going to really ask the question of, so did you actually get the data that you're claiming that you had? Like, that's, you know, kind of
Well, and I'm also thinking this is still a fairly young area of research or, you know, building research. Just knowing, kind of outside of what you do with your company and what they do, this kind of, you know, it's a fairly recent transition that different healthcare systems are making to, you know, away from paper data or paper records to, you know, computer based, you know, and so figuring out how to navigate that, you know, that opens up this possibility where information is available to then look at and learn from, but also, you know, making sure that there is a good sense of how it's all managed and worked with.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say it's a new, you know, and new maybe feels weird because we're probably talking about, you know, 10 years. It's been 10 years since, you know, the meaningful use legislation, you know, give or take, it's about 10 years. You know, it's about 20 years since, you know, it was around the year 2000 that electronic health records, you know, as a rough, you know, round number to deal with, it was around then that electronic health records really started to become a thing. Obviously, there were places that were doing them beforehand, and there are places that still are, you know, kind of slow to uptake. But, you know, it was a rough kind of mile marker. We've only been at this for about 20 years, and it was only about 10 years ago that there was this meaningful use legislation that really kind of put an impetus on, we want to make this work in a way that benefits us more broadly instead of just making individual hospitals have more electronic data that they mm-hmm. that they can use internally. We want to make sure that data from one software system and data from another software system can be interwoven and shared, and that the software can interact with each other, and that there are ways to aggregate things for the benefit of public health and things like that. And so, you know, 10 years may seem like a long time, but, you know, from my observations, it's just a sector that moves slowly. And so, you know, we are still trying to figure out, you know, and a lot of those rules about meaningful use, a lot of those suggested meaningful use were still focused on patient benefits, you know, making sure that I as a patient can have all of my health records not have, you know, well, this doctor has these and that doctor has those and this pharmacy has some other records, but kind of making sure that I as a patient have the access to the best data about my own health, and that all of my doctors have the best, and pharmacists and so forth have the best access to all the data so that they can give me the best care and those kinds of things. And as a, you know, kind of a side benefit of that, we're seeing that, well, it's creating this opportunity for more different kinds of biomedical research and public health research and so forth. And so because that wasn't even necessarily the primary goal, it wasn't the thing that we made sure we figured out all the answers to. And so, yeah, so I think we are still trying to work out what the standard is for, you know, publishing a paper on this kind of data, and how to, you know, again, like I said, how to ask the right questions at all the different stages. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it kind of came out in such a visible way in this particular instance, but hopefully it means that things will improve going forward. And I, you know, and because I don't think there was, you know, I don't think this is an example of, oh, you know, the science got it wrong necessarily. It just, you know, there was a science process that is still being figured out.
Yeah, I think as an outsider
And also, well, this is also going to feed into, you know, me being the artist. Art is all about the process. I think science, a lot of science, is all about the process, and that it's not necessarily this black and white. This is, we've learned it, that there's constant refinement in everything that that is researched. And I think that's a good thing. And I think we need to keep remembering that as a community going forward is, you know, yeah, it's just, you know, the idea that this is this process, and this process ultimately benefits us in so many ways. I mean, if we had stopped in any, you know, pick just anything that we've learned over the past, well, forever, you know, if they just stopped the minute they got it wrong, what would that, where would we be, you know, thinking about, I guess, the light bulb and Edison and how many things he had to try to get the light bulb to work, you know, that kind of, you know, that's what we want. We want that refinement. We want that testing and trying and, you know, that'll benefit us more than, haha, you got it wrong. We can't trust you. You don't know what you're doing kind of reaction that you get from some groups. So.
Yeah, you know, science is a human activity carried out by imperfect humans. And so it is best accomplished when we're all, you know, working together on the same, you know, in the same direction, and all, you know, constantly trying to review and double check and so forth. And so the fact that, you know, sometimes we need to take a step back and say, you know what, I thought I was right, but then, you know, a bunch of other people helped me to see where I was overlooking something or had a blind spot in what I was doing, has helped me to kind of course correct. I think that is appropriate rather than something that should be punished. You know, now maybe not learning from that mistake and making the same mistake over and over again, that's another issue. But I think, you know, everybody's going to make some mistakes, and everybody is going to have things that they haven't learned yet that they still need an opportunity to learn. And, you know, ideally we want to make sure that we're learning those things as early as possible, but, you know, sometimes it is going to come later in the process than we would have liked. And I think, you know, that says something about not just how we do science, but, you know, we're talking about how to mitigate the spread of the disease. You know, there's no perfect mask, right? But if everybody is wearing, you know, an imperfect mask, then we get a much better benefit than if we all just go, it's not perfect, so yeah, I'm not going to bother. So well,
sounds like we're wrapping up.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap up. I think it's a good place to once again reiterate, you know, thank you and good work to all the people that are doing what they can to look out for their neighbors and their communities and so forth by wearing masks, by staying home when they can, by being mindful about how they're interacting when they are out in public, and, you know, also the folks that are standing up for the neighbors and their communities by, you know, asking for greater justice and all that in society as well.
So keep washing your hands, not touching your face. Now plan to get a flu shot.
Well, you've got some time, but yes, come the fall, think about getting that flu shot. All right, we'll talk to you next time.